Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa!
Potluck. And you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club, a podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And welcome back to our June mid-month check-in. On this episode, we'll be talking about the latest book news happening in Asian American literature. As always, thanks to Rira for putting together the list that we're going to be going through. I don't know, it's a little bit shorter this month, huh?
Yeah, it is. I think we covered a lot of ground in the last two episodes where we briefly covered news. So there aren't a lot of book deals, but some big piece of news happened earlier last week, and we're probably going to talk mostly about that. If you're into the Asian American community, if you're plugged in, you probably know what it is.
And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about what happened with Nono Boy and Penguin Classics this past week.
So Marvin, have you made any headway into this month's book?
No, I have not started.
And for those of you who don't know what this month's book club pick is, it's Haruki Murakami's Kafka on the Shore.
Our first Murakami.
Yes, our very first Murakami book that either of us have ever read in our lives.
I have it. It's loaded up in my Kindle. I'm ready to read it. Just this past week has been filled with following video game news.
Yeah, same here. I just got my copy yesterday in the mail because I wanted to own it. But there was the cover that is mostly used now, the paperback that is most popular, it's the Vintage International cover. And that's the cover that you have, Marvin, which is ugly and bluish gray.
It's not the one with the face on Goodreads, right?
No, it is not the one with the face on Goodreads. Here, I'll show you my cover. So I went on Amazon to find this very specific cover because I really did not want the ugly cover because this is going on my bookshelf. So I got the one where the cover is black and there's a black cat on a red circle that kind of looks like a profile of a face.
It kind of looks like the Thundercats.
Oh, it does. You're right. Yeah. So that's how far I go when it comes to getting the editions I like for
this
my
is
bookshelf.
True, because when I was in China, I went to their only Western bookstores, and I was showing the covers of all like the international versions, and you're really geeking out about it.
Yes, the Three Dark Crowns. They have like manga-esque.
Oh, that's
covers.
Pretty badass, yeah.
Yeah, that series is by Kendara Blake, and it's about three queens kind of fighting for the ultimate throne. And
right.
Yeah, it's a really badass series, and I was really upset that they did not have those options here in America.
I know, right? I feel like it just pops, like, because the cover in the American version is just a crown.
It's like three crowns.
Three dark crowns,
yeah.
Right?
Marvin and I are really into video games,
yeah.
So most of our time this past week has just been catching up on E3 news.
Watching people watch press conferences.
You know what? And that is the only way I can watch E3 now. I can't watch the press conferences by itself because I can't take them seriously.
We should really have, like, maybe, like we said,
as a perk.
Bonus content, us just talking about other forms of media, because we do more than just read.
That's true. And to our detriment, sometimes we postpone a lot of things because we end up playing video games or some other interest.
Binge TV.
Or, binge TV, yeah. Killing Eve, you know. If you are into us talking about more video games, just let us know on Twitter so we can just gauge.
Like, we just do a whole new games and
I just want to know, like, yeah. How... like, if anyone is interested, or if it's just us talking about it and, like, no one listening to us.
We are merging our fandoms right now.
I know.
But, yeah, what's been going on in the world of book news in Asian American literature?
All right, we're going to start with our only book deal amongst our book news. Crown Books has acquired Ellen O's middle grade novel, The Colliding Worlds of Mina Lee, along with a second untitled YA novel. In the books, Mina Lee is transported into her own webcomic, only to find that none of her characters are doing what they're supposed to. Publication of the first book is set for summer 2021.
And this is Ellen O of We Need Diverse Books fame, right?
Yes.
Awesome. Congratulations to Ellen. This sounds like fun. Like, I'm always glad to see more diversity in like YA fiction.
I'm more excited for middle grade fiction, actually. I feel like more diversity has kind of seeped into that like tier of readers, and that's great because you're starting at a much younger age.
That's
teaching
true.
Kids empathy, teaching kids about the world, really. So that's really great.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like it's... Is it easier? Because, like youth fiction, as with, like, genre fiction, it's easier to kind of incorporate diversity in there because you're not playing with conventions and, like, the rules.
I'm not sure. From a lot of authors who write YA, they also write adult novels where their original YA novel was actually pitched as an adult novel until marketing changed it. I feel like YA has become like so, I don't know, saturated, and no one really quite knows like who it's for anymore. Like, originally it was for teens who, because like the main characters in YA novels are usually like 16 to maybe like 21 years old.
Right. They're like, they're all coming of age stories.
Yeah. They're all coming of age stories. Usually they're fast paced. Usually, it reads much faster and more concentrated than like a literary fiction novel, for example. I feel like a lot of literary fiction novels I have read has been like more sprawling and more it's more of like character study rather than like fast-paced action,
right.
Or rom-com streamlined storylines. But
right, they feel more cinematic, right?
Yeah,
in terms of
yeah.
like the way the stories are told.
And of course, like, it depends on genres. Like, it depends if it's like sci-fi or like fantasy or whatnot.
They're like the CW of the literary world.
I would really argue against that because there are a lot of YA novels that read like adult novels to me, and a lot of YA novels that are better than a lot of literary fiction that I've read in my life. And
well, I feel like a lot of the fans of YA that we know of are like our age,
which comes with its positives and negatives, because also like we as adults are invading like a space of teenagers, and
I'm still playing video games, so
I wouldn't say like invading, but like what I feel like a lot of Goodreads reviewers who review like YA books who are like over the age of 30,
yeah,
like sometimes the reviews that they leave, especially the negative ones, they say, oh, I couldn't relate to this character. And it's like, you're not supposed to. You're not the main demographic. And it's okay to, you know, not enjoy the book because of that. But also, like, to go on Goodreads and to, like, kind of trash a book because of that is like, terrible. And also, because like more and more adults are reading YA novels because it's a lot faster to read, like I feel like a lot of the teens who are reading YA, their voices are kind of being subdued, and marketing and like publicists, they're not really engaging with them as much as they should.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, this is me. Like, this is my take on it as someone who is, like, an amateur. I'm not an industry expert, and I definitely don't keep up.
We have a podcast.
Everyone has a podcast. But like I said, I'm not an industry expert, and I definitely don't read as much as professional book bloggers do. But that is just my personal take on it. And it would be really interesting to bring someone who is like a publicist or a publisher or an editor and just talk more about this topic.
Yeah. I mean, it's a valid take. And I think, I mean, I know we're on Goodreads, but sometimes, like, Goodreads is pretty much Yelp for books, right?
The only time when it becomes like really detrimental is when the Goodreads reviews, like really popular Goodreads reviewers, will give a book like 1 or 2 stars based on just that. Like, oh, I didn't relate to the character, or I didn't learn this from this culture that this book is promoting, so therefore it only gets 2 stars. Or they say, oh, they just ripped off like their own history of like of this Chinese dynasty.
These names sound fake. No one's named Twinkle.
Yeah, like stuff like that. And then it affects like how, like if it affects like other people who might want to read it. Like they might say, okay, well, this person is saying it's bad, so maybe I won't read it. Or they'll go in with already a prejudice in their headspace. So
yeah,
there's a lot of Goodreads. Wow, that is a totally separate episode we should do. That is another freaking like TED Talk.
Yeah. Just hang out at Books and Boba, the group on Goodreads, and just chat with us. It's a lot nicer,
okay.
I promise.
All right, so yeah, we're going
to congratulations to Ellen O on her book deal. Excited for you, and would love to talk to you one of these days just about your work on both writing and promoting diverse literature. Hit us up.
Moving on to news.
Sharp Objects creator Marty Noxon and executive producer Jessica Rhodes have optioned the film and TV rights to Abdi Nazamian's YA novel, Like a Love Story.
So, Like a Love Story, it's a YA novel that follows 3 teens living in New York City during the AIDS crisis in 1989, early 90s.
Oh.
And it centers on Reza, who is an Iranian boy who is still closeted as a gay teen, and but he's very afraid to come out because this is during the AIDS crisis, and the only gay figures that he knows have been gay men with AIDS, and then there's another teenager named Judy who is an aspiring fashion designer, and her uncle is a gay man with AIDS, and she devotes her time with activism. And Judy falls for Reza. And, of course, that has complications because Reza is gay. And then the third teenager that the story focuses on is Art, who is Judy's best friend and the school's only out and proud teen. And Reza and Art grow closer together. And of course, that is kind of like an awkward love triangle situation.
Yeah.
So it sounds very, of course, it is very coming of age.
Yeah.
And
a lot of drama.
A lot of drama will make for a very good TV or film.
Yeah.
So congratulations.
Yeah, that sounds super interesting. You know, typically these stories focus on like the societal pressures. But it sounds like Reza, the main character, also has like cultural pressures too.
Yeah.
No, that would be interesting.
Which is nice, you know. You have a queer teen of color.
Yeah.
Next up, we have the Lambda Literary Award winners. So here are the winners who are of Asian descent.
Because that's all we care about.
That is not... Okay, well, this is the focus of the podcast, but congratulations to all of the winners. You can find the list of winners on Bustle and also at the Lambda Literary Award website. But I am just going to go through the winners that...
I'm sure they're all fine.
I'm going to go through the winners that... match the focus of this podcast. So for lesbian fiction, congratulations to Larissa Lai, the author of The Tiger Flu. And for best bisexual fiction, we have Disoriental by Nagar Javadi. And the winner for bisexual poetry is We Play a Game by Dui Duan. And for LGBTQ drama, we have Draw the Circle by Mashuk Mushtaq Dean. Last but not least, we have for LGBTQ erotica, we have Miles and Honesty in SCFSX by Blue Deliquanti and Casimir Lee.
Wow. Congrats to all the award winners that, let's just say, I care about.
Your words, not mine. Also, I apologize for any mispronunciations.
Yeah, that's all the big news that has happened since our last check-in. As always, if there's anything that pops up that you want to get on our radar for the next news roundup, or you want to just let people know about, there is a news thread going on our Goodreads forums under the news desk category, I guess. So if you see anything that you want to bring to our attention, feel free to post there, and we'll do our best to highlight it in our next episode.
Also, if you find anything on Twitter, you can tag us at Books and Boba.
Yeah, that too.
All right, moving on to,
I guess, the biggest piece of news in our world.
I was trying to think of like an idiom, but it just, I was about to say elephant in the room, but that wasn't it.
So we mentioned the Penguin Classics re-release of four revered Asian American quote unquote classics, right? Like classical books that are basically taught in every Asian American studies course. One of which includes John Okada's Nono Boy, which I remember reading when I took Asian American literature.
It is the first Japanese American novel, right?
Yeah.
Written in English.
Yeah, it was written by John Okada, who was part of the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans in World War II. He wrote it within 10 years of coming out of the camps. And it didn't really take off because it was a very traumatic time for the JA community. So I think people were just like, why are you writing about this stuff?
Yeah, and I think everyone really wanted to move on from the war. So it was definitely timing. And actually, Okada based the main character in the novel from a friend, like on a friend who was sent to prison for refusing the draft.
Right, because Okada himself was not a no-no boy. No. He served in the 442nd. He fought in, I think he served in the Pacific Theater, actually, as a translator.
Yeah, as a translator, yeah.
Which actually meant he probably didn't serve in the 442nd, because that was they served in the German theater.
Oh, okay.
The European theater, yeah.
But he was in Japan during the brief U.S. Occupation.
Yeah. But for people who don't know, and I can't remember the exact numbers of the questions, but Nono Boy refers to people who answered no to two questions in basically this survey that was sent out in the camps to essentially draft Japanese Americans into the U.S. Army. One of them asked whether they would serve in the U.S. Army, and the other one asked, would they declare absolute loyalty to the United States? And most people said yes, because they were really eager to show that they were Americans. But there was a significant number of people who put no on both of those, because in their minds, like, as Americans, because a lot more U.S.-born citizens, they shouldn't be asked these questions while they're being incarcerated. And again, I'm paraphrasing my limited knowledge of this period in time, but there was a lot of, like, a lot of the draft resistors, the Nono Boys, were ostracized in the community because they essentially were like, you're just proving to them that we're not
loyal. Yes.
And there's a lot of, like, just tension there that now that we're reading, we realize how much this whole mass incarceration, like, really fucked people up.
We're also seeing history repeat itself now,
in
like the current political climate with immigration and incarceration of children. Yeah. But it is such a cornerstone in Asian American literature, which is why it is taught in every single Asian American literature class, like you said.
Yeah, because it's not a story about immigration or about like expectations from parents. It's about like this really messed up thing that happened to people because of their otherness and how people dealt with that. And it was one of the first books to talk about the internment camps in fiction in a very direct way, right? There's not a lot of fiction from that time period about this stuff. There's a couple more these days, but they're all written by people who weren't there.
Or written by the children of those who were interned. Yeah. Or they're very academic books that are mostly just about history, which are very, very important, but like fiction.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like fiction hits you where, like, I don't know. Like, to me, fiction sinks in more than nonfiction.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I get into like the character's mindset or role or whatever. But
yeah, I mean, we were forced. we were required to read Farewell to Manzanar in high school, which is a memoir. So it's not exactly fiction. It's more nonfiction. But even that is like not a standardized requirement in like the country, right?
That was extra reading for my middle school class. Mm. And I was like, sure, I'll read this. And that was the first time I knew about Japanese internment. And it's kind of horrifying because that was elective reading. And it's like, what the fuck, man? Like, like that should have been mandatory reading if it covered such an important part of U.S. history.
I think in California, it's, I don't know if it's still required, but it's on like the list of books that you assign like your sophomore high school class.
Well, I went to elementary and middle school in the East Coast, so
in the South, right?
Well, I moved to Georgia in like towards the tail end of middle school,
okay.
So most of my childhood was spent in the East Coast.
Mm.
So
yeah, but
very far removed.
Why are we talking about No-No Boy?
So we are talking about No-No Boy because recently. I think it was for Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, so it was in May.
Mm-hmm.
And Penguin Random House released a couple of titles by Asian American authors.
Yeah, these were the books that we saw our friend Phil and Christine unbox that we were like, why didn't we get
them? Why didn't we get them? But so like John Okada's No-No Boy was one of the novels, and they got caught into this copyright dispute because Penguin Random House says that No-No Boy is under public domain, whereas it's hard to explain this because we have to like go through the history of how No-No Boy became published and how it became like a requirement in Asian American literature.
Yeah.
So what happened is
So
No-No Boy was published actually in Japan through a Japanese publisher. It was printed in English language, and it was printed under Tuttle Publishing back in 1957.
Right, this was the first edition.
This was the very first edition, and it did not do well.
Right.
And a couple of years later, Sean Wong, who is now an English professor at University of Washington, he and his friends, they discovered Okada's book in a used bookstore in 1971.
This is why I support your local bookstores.
Yes. And they were like, wow, this is a really important novel, because it was like the first novel that they've come across that talked about Japanese internment.
Mm-hmm.
So they went to publishers asking if they would be willing to republish the book. And most of the publishers said no. There is no like interest
who
in
is this.
Who is
for?
Who's gonna read this?
Who wants to read about Japanese Americans?
And so what happened was Sean Wong and his friends Jeffrey Paul Chan, Frank Chin, and Lawson Fusao Inada, they sold the copies themselves. They only sold like maybe I'm guessing here around like 6,000 copies, and eventually, in 1976, Wong copyrighted the novel on behalf of Dorothy Okada.
Right, because the author had passed away.
Because the author had passed away from a heart attack when he was around 47. So he passed away very young.
Yeah, I think he passed away like literally just before Sean and his friends discovered his novel.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, I think so. But Wong copyrighted the novel on behalf of the widow of John Okada for the CARP edition of the novel. And CARP stands for Combined Asian American Resources Project.
And that was the group that him and his friends used to get the second printing done.
Yes,
right?
Yes. So they pretty much got people to buy the book within the community by advertising on a Japanese American newspaper, yeah, offering like $2 discounts. And
it's important to note that this was probably the same time that the whole reparations debate was like in full force, right? I don't know the exact time frame, so I may be wrong, but this was a time when Sansei, like third generation Japanese Americans, were starting to realize that internment happened, because it wasn't something the community talked about. And like the Nisei and Issei were like, a lot of them were actually trying to just like forget about it and like bury it.
Yeah. Very like, it was a very crucial time,
yeah,
in terms of like recovering from the war. And
it was a time when the next generation was kind of discovering that there was this really messed up thing that their country did to their,
yes,
families. And they wanted to learn more.
Yeah. And so like they sold the books themselves under CARP.
Mm-hmm.
And they transferred the rights in 1979 to the University of Washington Press, who is still the publishers of,
yeah,
of the book. And so
I got my copy back in 2005. So I'm assuming I have one of the University of Washington Press ones.
From, yeah, University of Washington Press. And they've been keeping the book in print for more than 40 years. And they do pay royalties to the Okada family. So they handle all of the rights and the, mm-hmm, royalties. But Penguin, when they announced that they were doing the Asian American classics, they apparently said that the book is under public domain in the U.S. And because it wasn't properly registered, the 1957 edition of the novel was not properly registered.
Yeah, I think their argument is that the copyright from 1976 only covers the updated foreword.
Yeah, only the foreword,
but not
the
actual text, which was, which because the original book was released in 1957 in public domain, because it's like 50 years, 60 years,
yes,
is the statute of limitations on that.
And it's like very, very complicated because No No Boy was published through a Japanese publisher, but,
yeah,
Okada is an American citizen. And also the U.S. wasn't part of the Berne Convention, which is also like kind of in charge of like pretty much copyrights from different countries.
I mean, we were just talking about like cyberpunk capitalism running rampant. And this is like, like the optics of this is all bad, because it's like, okay, so you are essentially punishing this scrappy group of people trying to preserve this seminal work because John Okada had to go through a Japanese publisher because America wasn't ready for this book back then.
Yeah.
You know?
Dorothea Okada, who is John Okada's daughter, she spoke to the New York Times, and she said that her family was unaware of any issues with copyright issues, and that the family wasn't contacted by Penguin before the new edition was published.
Right.
So that is the main...
Right, so they weren't aware of any copyright issue because they weren't aware Penguin was publishing this book until they announced it.
Yes, so pretty much Penguin just kind of went ahead because they're like, it's in public domain, like we have the rights to publish this under our publishing house.
Yeah.
And they didn't go ahead and get authorization from the Okada family. Even
or even
though,
blessing.
Yeah,
the blessing,
like,
right?
The thing is, like, yeah, maybe legally speaking, they didn't need it and they could have just like gone through with it, which they did. But the right thing to have,
yeah,
done was to ask the family first.
I mean, they may have the legal right of way, so to say, but this just reeks of like bad faith business.
I will read a quote that they gave to the New York Times. This is their statement. "We acted in good faith to pursue No No Boy for publication. Our intent is to continue important conversations around No No Boy through its inclusion in the Penguin Classics series."
Yeah. I mean, obviously, Penguin is a corporation. Corporations have PR people on retainer to like do these statements. And just because they say it's in good faith, like the fact that they didn't even
ask the family, that is the first step in any good faith. Ask first. And
like, who has the rights? And like maybe even looking into the history of this specific book. Because
the history of getting this book published is probably like equally important as the work itself.
I mean, it could be its own. I mean, yeah, they make movies about like discovering this old text of someone who like, you know, passed away thinking no one wanted to read it. Right.
Yeah. This book is so important to the community, and the community really fought for this book to be published. It exists, and it is in classrooms because of the community, and a corporation just picking that up and not understanding like the gravity of the situation is kind of like ridiculous. And the thing is, so Penguin's argument that the 1957 edition is, you know, now public domain because the only part that is protected by copyright law is the foreword.
Right.
But the thing is, there's proof that Penguin appropriated from the UW Press edition. One sign is the John Okada signature at the end of
the preface, which was a typo because
it wasn't a typo, but like it his name was on there as if it was like nonfiction, like as if the story was a memoir, and it's not. It's completely fiction,
right?
And they fixed that error in later editions, but this error only showed up in the 2014 redesign of the book, and that's the book with the blue cover with Jillian Tamaki's illustration on it.
So for those of you following along, that means that they don't have the original manuscript or the original 1957 version.
No, they scanned readily available copy of this book, and they just ran with it. And like that was like a crucial error in No-No Boy that University of Washington like removed from all of their subsequent editions. So it's just like, wow, you didn't even go through the effort of fixing a mistake that was caught on pretty early.
Yeah.
Like, and then there's also the fact that they lifted a quote from Ruth Ozeki's foreword in one of the University of Washington Press's edition. I think it was the same one, the 2014 edition. They lifted a quote from there. And I'm like, she didn't give that to you? Like,
yeah.
So it's like they say that because it's public domain and because like the only thing that is protected is the foreword, they still lifted things that...
Yeah.
Like... that weren't a part of the like. I don't know how to explain this other than the fact that it just feels like Penguin Random House like copied someone's like homework.
Yeah, I mean,
but not in a good way. They like missed answers on the Scantron.
The overall story here is Penguin did something shitty that wasn't against the rules per se, but still pretty shitty. And now they're trying to explain, oh, but we follow the rules, so we're cool. Right. And I think their official statement was that they are reaching out to the Okada family or the Okada estate to talk terms, I guess. But like.
But there has been no confirmation on whether or not the Okada family is going to get any royalties from the Penguin Random House sales, right. Which I think like it's never going to happen because it's a big corporation. But it would be. Like a gesture of goodwill if they just went ahead and did that anyway.
So there's now two versions of this book out in circulation. There is the authorized by the family University of Washington Press version, and there's the unauthorized corporate Penguin version.
And a bunch of really well-known Asian American authors who are also professors at a lot of universities, like Viet Thanh Nguyen, who... you know, he read, he's the author of The Sympathizer, which we read for this book club. He said that he will only use the University of Washington Press's copies for his class. And a lot of other Asian American authors said the same thing. So it seems like it's kind of like an across-the-board decision by the Asian American community to only use the...
Yeah, I mean, for people who have been teaching Asian American studies, like this is like this is the book you assign in your 101 class, right? To illustrate, to talk about this specific period in time. And so it is in a lot of classrooms, and it is being, it gets assigned a lot, especially like, you know, not in every school, because not every school has Asian American Studies, but it's one of the books, like, I would say even above, like, Joy Luck Club, right?
It's, yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
like, it's a book that you, I mean, every class, it's this, it's Woman Warrior, and some Native Speaker.
America's the Heart.
Yeah. And it tarnishes, like, the goodwill that Penguin built for having this collection in the first place.
I'm not saying that, like, Penguin is evil, because they have plenty of very talented and dedicated Asian American editors, agents, and authors under their belt. They are trying really hard to promote diversity and to introduce diversity to their young readers. But, you know, like, corporations make mistakes.
Yeah.
And, like, this is a really big one.
But corporations also don't like admitting it.
That's true.
Right.
For legal reasons.
Yeah. So it just feels like this is what happens when a corporation, like, does make a mistake but aren't allowed to really have a good faith argument about it because of all the lawyers and all the PR people that are involved now.
Yeah, I know that when, like, the Penguin Classics edition was announced, people were very, very excited that these books were now going under, like, a big publisher.
Yeah.
And it's really sad that, like, Okada's legacy, which should have been celebrated for Asian American Pacific Heritage Month, like, that kind of got tarnished by this copyright, like, dispute.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, what a bummer. Like, like, this was supposed to be a moment where we're like, yes, we quote unquote made it.
We have classics now.
We have classics now. We're like dead white people.
that are recognized by a corporation publishing house.
It's a big deal. Mm. And, you know, it is really disappointing.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, if you have thoughts about this issue or thoughts about Nono Boy in general, please let us know on our Goodreads forums. We'd love to hear your thoughts and chat with you about this as well. It's been a while since we've had, like, one of these, like, issues that, like, kind of took over
Uh-oh.
Twitter for a bit, you know.
Uh-oh, the pot got too hot.
But yeah, I mean, it's important because, like we were said, the story of this book being published is essentially the same. It's the same story we've been having. It's the same, like, narrative that we've been dealing with of, like, representation and what it took for this story to even make it in the classrooms was, like, a really gargantuan effort, because, like, this book could have easily just been lost to time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it was for a number of years until Sean Wong found it with his friends.
Yeah.
And it's really sad. Like, I keep saying that, but it really is.
Yeah, I mean, John Okada died with this book being an unsuccessful, like, venture. Like, this was his only book.
This was his only book, and from what I have read, when it was announced that his book was going to actually be published, I mean, it's going to be published through a Japanese publisher, mm-hmm. he was very, very proud of himself. And he was like, oh, man, I'm like, I want to quit my job. But I can't. I was like, I'm so excited for people to read my work. And it's just so tragic that he did not live long enough to see, like, what an impact it has made in this community and to, like, not just other authors who are rising up in like, publishing today, but also, like, Asian American filmmakers and yeah. Asian American, like, screenwriters.
I mean, it's also a stage play.
Yeah, it's a yeah. stage yeah. play, too. And, you know, like, think about, like, Allegiance, for example. Mm. That is, like, it's not an adaptation of No No Boy, but, like, it's part of that, I guess, canon.
Mm-hmm.
So it has definitely influenced a lot of different Asian American creators across art forms. And yeah, it's all I can say is it's sad. It's disappointing.
Yeah.
I hope we can do better moving forward.
Feels bad. And we hope that, you know, the story's still ongoing. You know, there's still, like, it's not as hot as last week, but it's still, like, we're still waiting for to see what Penguin does. Or if they even do anything.
Yeah.
Right, so... yeah, we'll keep tracking the story on our Goodreads forum. If there's any updates, we'll let you all know. But on that note, I guess that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thanks for joining us once again as we talk about mostly book stuff.
Mostly book stuff. If you even made it past the E3 talk, I congratulate you.
And if you want more E3 talk, let's talk on the Goodreads forums, I guess. Reminder once again that our June book club pick is Kafka on the Shore by Haruki Murakami. Looking forward to reading it. Looking forward to, you know, seeing what all the hubbub is about.
Yeah. It's a lot longer than I thought it would be when I got my copy. I was like, oh, it's thick. And
how's the font size?
Want to see?
Tell me about this cat.
Like,
oh yeah, that's pretty.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty chunky. It's a chunky boy with like very narrow margins, and I'm a little bit scared because we're halfway into June and I haven't started.
Oh,
but I wanted my nice cover, so I guess it was worth it.
Yeah, I got my shitty Kindle cover, which is fine. I don't really look at it, so.
I was listening to it on audiobook for like the past 2 days, but like no luck absorbing any of the information. So now I have to go start over again.
What's your what's your listening speed on audiobook?
For this one, it was 1.25 because the narrator just kind of like the cadence was weird when I made it faster.
Right. Yeah, I usually go
like 1.5.
Yeah, that usually looks like. It's enough so that it's faster, but not chipmunk, right?
Yeah. The interesting thing about the audiobook, though, they have two narrators.
Oh.
And I think that's...
On the same track? On the same, like, audiobook?
Yeah, in the same audiobook. Oh. So I'm guessing that's because it alternates perspectives. Oh. I don't know. Like, while I was listening to it, I was working, and that was a really bad idea. Like, I couldn't focus on anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's denser than our typical read, which
yeah. At least it's not IQ84. That book is 900 pages. I don't think I could ever do that for book club.
We'll be talking about Kafka on the Shore at the end of the month. So by then, you and I will be Haruki Murakami experts.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Thanks again for listening to Books and Boba. We are a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Check out our fellow Potluck podcasts by going to the website www.podcastpotluck.com. And special thanks to Visual Communications. This podcast was recorded at the Potluck Podcast Studios, located at the Visual Communications offices in downtown Los Angeles. You can check them out at vcmedia.org. And yeah, on that note, thanks for listening. Rira, I'll see you in a few weeks.
Cool.
But we're still here, and we're going strong.
It's an exciting time in Asian America. There are more movies, TV shows, books, and music reflecting us than ever. But all of these represent just a small slice of Asian American culture and experiences. So what do? Tell more slices. Asian Americana is a show that explores these slices of distinctly Asian American culture and history. We've talked about how Chinese Americans built California's Sacramento Delta, the art scene turns gallery institution Giant Robot, a play that explores the lost Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s, and, of course, Boba, just to name a few stories. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or on your podcast app.
Tired of proof.